any moment now, we'll be crossing to the California White House in San Clemente for a live coverage of President Richard Nixon's broadcast to the American nation. White House spokesmen have described tonight's statement as a major announcement. But perhaps the most dramatic aspect of the speech is that these spokesmen have absolutely refused to say what it will be about.
The announcement I shall now read is being issued simultaneously in Peking and in the United States. Premier Chou En-lai and Dr. Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's assistant for national security affairs, held talks in Peking from July 9 to 11, 1971. Knowing of President Nixon's expressed desire to visit the People's Republic of China, Premier Chou En-lai, on behalf of the government of the People's Republic of China, has extended an invitation to President Nixon to visit China at an appropriate date before May 1972. President Nixon has accepted the invitation with pleasure.
Hi there, I'm Tom Morton. Welcome to Hindsight on ABC Radio National and the fourth episode of Torn Curtain, the secret history of the Cold War. Today we go behind the scenes of a week that changed the world. A week when President Nixon shook hands with Chairman Mao. And that handshake would mark a major turning point in Cold War history.
It certainly shifted the world balance of power. It reinforced the American position considerably. It gave a form of legitimacy to the Chinese regime, which it had never had before, and which enabled it, as you know, subsequently to expand its diplomatic activities globally. So it was a very, very important step.
What's often referred to as Richard Nixon's opening to China in the early 1970s had repercussions that spread beyond Asia and throughout the world. But even before news of Nixon's visit to Beijing was announced, Gough Whitlam undertook his own opening to China. In July 1971, Whitlam travelled to Beijing to meet the Chinese Prime Minister Zhou En-lai.
I heard that your party advocates the complete withdrawal of all the U.S. forces of aggression who were sent to Vietnam by the Australian government.
Yes.
Is that so?
That is so.
That's part of a historic recording of Whitlam's meeting with Zhou, which we'll hear more of later in the program. Whitlam was still leader of the opposition at the time, and as we'll also hear, that meeting caused a political sensation in Australia. But Whitlam's visit to China was just a prelude to another, much more momentous visit, one hidden behind a curtain of silence and secrecy.
Would anyone like a cigarette? No one wants one? No, I found a party that doesn't smoke. First of all, I'd like to welcome you, especially as Dr. Kissinger is the special representative of the president.
It is a great pleasure to be here. I have looked forward a long time to this opportunity. As I have already pointed out to you, President Nixon has asked me to convey to you and Chairman Mao his high personal regards. He looks forward to meeting with the leaders of the People's Republic of China personally to exchange ideas.
We thank His Excellency the President for his regards.
The President asked that this mission be secret until after we meet, so we can meet unencumbered by bureaucracy, free of the past, and with the greatest possible latitude.
You don't like bureaucracy either.
Yes, and it's mutual. The bureaucracy doesn't like me.
That's a dramatic reconstruction of the talks between Henry Kissinger and the Chinese Prime Minister Zhou Enlai in Beijing in July 1971. Unlike Whitlam's visit, which took place in a glare of publicity, Kissinger went there under secrecy so great that even the US State Department didn't know about it. The original transcript of his talks with Zhou Enlai is marked top secret, sensitive, exclusively eyes only. It wasn't released for nearly 30 years. And in retrospect, that's hardly surprising, because what Kissinger put on the table there was no less than a major reversal of US foreign policy. Bernd Schaefer.
So if some of those things would have been leaked at the time in the United States, I mean, this would have had major repercussions. I mean, just the first visit of Kissinger with Zhou Enlai, what he was saying there on Taiwan and Vietnam and Korea, I mean, if this would have been published in the United States, I mean, this would have doomed the Nixon administration from the very beginning. It would have been a disaster because in American eyes, he was basically giving away, selling away the shop.
You could say that our story today is a geopolitical romance between Mao, the great helmsman, and Nixon, the man who Chinese propaganda called the jittery chieftain of US imperialism.
Mr. Nixon quoted Mao Zedong. "Seize the day, seize the hour," said the president. "Let us start a long march together."
And that romance has become the stuff of legend. The American composer John Adams even wrote an opera about it, which we're listening to now. Nixon, the hard-headed Cold War warrior, was swept off his feet by Mao's charisma. So eager was Nixon to court Mao that he was prepared to dump America's long-standing ally, the Chinese nationalist government in Taiwan. Yet at the time their courtship began, publicly at least, the US and China couldn't have been further apart. China was isolated from the international community. Chinese and American troops had fought each other in Korea, and Washington didn't even recognise the communist government in Beijing. So what were Nixon and Kissinger hoping to achieve by wooing their enemy? Here to help us understand is William Smizer. He was a senior staff member of the National Security Council at the time.
They felt, and I felt, that we were stuck in a rut. We were stuck in a rut on Vietnam, which was a difficult war, to put it mildly. We were stuck in a rut in the negotiations with the Soviet Union, which seemed to go on eternally but never found a solution. We were also stuck in a rut with the American people, who were discouraged about whether foreign policy could ever produce anything good. And we all felt, and Nixon particularly, that there was an opening to be made on China. He had written about this. He had thought about it a great deal. And he thought this was the break we needed in order to get us started on a new course.
Nixon also had a pressing political reason to do a deal with the Chinese because it would put the Vietnam disaster in a new context. If the Americans were going to live and let live with China in Asia after the Korean War and the Vietnam War had been such costly sagas out of the hostility between Beijing and Washington. If he could do that, the withdrawal from Vietnam wouldn't look so bad.
Journalist and academic Ross Terrell. Terrell first visited China as a student during the Cultural Revolution. He'd go on to write a number of books on China which influenced American foreign policy experts, including Kissinger himself. Even before Richard Nixon was elected president, he'd given a speech saying that the world couldn't afford to leave China outside the family of nations. Nixon believed it was time to move away from the strategies of containment and isolation which had dominated American policy towards China for 20 years.
That's right. And the funny thing about it is that everybody heard him and everybody read what he said, but they paid no attention to it. They said, well, Nixon is an old cold warrior. He's a right winger. He's not going to do anything new. The press, in any case, was totally seized with Vietnam. So he could say all these things and people would hear it, but they wouldn't listen.
Well, funnily enough, the people who did seem to listen were the Chinese.
Oh, they listened very carefully, and they gave a number of signals which indicated at least a passing interest and a desire to learn more.
We are caught in war wanting peace. We're torn by division wanting unity. We see around us empty lives wanting fulfillment. We see
Mao personally ordered the publication of the Inkai text of Nixon's speech in all major Chinese newspapers. This was unprecedented in the history of People's Republic of China. And in this way, to allow the educated Chinese at that time to read the text of the inaugural speech of an American president in its entirety, I think by itself, it was meaningful.
In these difficult years, America has suffered from a fever of words, from inflated rhetoric that promises more than it can deliver, from angry rhetoric that fans discontents into hatreds.
I was a 16-year-old at that time, and I was so amazed by reading Nixon's inaugural speech, and it was translated in beautiful Chinese.
So in a sense here, he was sending a signal both to the United States and to the Chinese population, yeah?
Yes, and I think more importantly, this should be regarded as an important signal to the Chinese population. I think that was just because of Nixon's particular statement about not allowing any country to live in angry isolation, and then Mao decided to publish the entire thing in major Chinese newspapers.
Chang Jian, the author of Mao's China and the Cold War. He's also Michael J. Zack Professor of History for U.S.-China Relations at Cornell University. When Richard Nixon said in his inaugural speech that no country should live in angry isolation, his words struck a chord with Chairman Mao. China wasn't only isolated at the end of the 1960s, it was facing its most perilous security situation since the communists had taken power 20 years earlier. The Americans had 500,000 troops in Vietnam and military bases in a sweeping arc all through Asia to China's east. But in Mao's mind, China was facing an even more dangerous adversary, its former ally, the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that is very true. You know, the Chinese-Soviet relations in the 1960s had been deteriorating so rapidly. And finally, in early 1969, a major border clash occurred between China and the Soviet Union. And this was followed by major military mobilization on the China side. So from Beijing's perspective in early 1969, the security situation China was facing was really grave.
Kissinger went to Nixon the day that the fighting broke out along the Usi River and said, this is something that is incredibly important. We're going to watch it very carefully, and they did.
When China was in a direct confrontation with the Soviet Union, it was simply inconceivable for Mao to maintain the same level of hostility and confrontation with the United States.
They felt, I felt, we all felt, and Nixon certainly felt, that this reflected an opening because the Chinese would not tolerate being in a situation where they were being attacked by the Soviets, as they saw it, and not have any kind of link to anybody else. They did not want to remain isolated.
Nixon and Kissinger saw themselves as master strategists playing the Chinese and the Soviets off against each other. But that, as we now know, was only half the picture. Secret documents unearthed by the historian Chang Jian in the Chinese archives reveal that Mao was playing his own game of strategic poker. Mao summoned four old marshals who'd been disgraced in the Cultural Revolution and told them to think unconventional thoughts about China's security situation. Here's what the four marshals came back with.
We need to consider playing the American card. You know, that was in the record of the discussions of the four marshals. In explicit language, you know, the play American card suggestion was by itself extremely unconventional in the situation of the late 1960s because the United States had been characterized as the chieftain of reactionary forces in the world for the previous two decades. But in retrospect, as a historian, I find it is almost natural. And in Chinese strategic culture, it is always justified that in order to deal with the most dangerous enemy, it is legitimate to try to seek compromise with the less dangerous enemy. This is in Chinese is called to use the barbarians to control another barbarian.
To use the barbarians to control another barbarian.
Yes. Yeah, the Soviet Union was the most dangerous barbarian, and then the United States, U.S. imperialists, who remain another barbarian, but it was less dangerous than the most dangerous barbarian.
In many ways, Mao and Nixon needed each other. But both of them had a PR problem, how to sell a rapprochement between China and the United States to their own populations. For Nixon, the biggest headache was the Taiwan lobby. During the Civil War in China in the late 1940s, America had supported the nationalist leader Chiang Kai-shek. When the communists won, Chiang Kai-shek went into exile in Taiwan. 20 years on, the United States still recognized the nationalist regime in Taiwan as the official government of China, and the Taiwan lobby in the US was very well connected in Washington.
They were powerful. First of all, they had money. Second, they had great sympathy among the American people. And, of course, also they had a number of very famous people, the Chanots and others who had been associated with them. There was great sympathy in the United States for Chiang Kai-shek. Life magazine publisher Henry Luce believed firmly in the nationalists, so that there was a great sense among many Americans that these were our friends in China. And we knew that the moment there was any kind of hint of an opening to China, that lobby would be on the rooftops, screaming and shouting. So secrecy was imperative both from the Chinese standpoint and ours.
For almost two decades, the anti-US imperialism had been used by Mao to mobilize the masses, to involve them in one after another domestic revolutionary campaigns. However, that Maoist revolutionary plans had repeatedly failed the test of people's lived experience.
In the late 1960s, this was the official sound of China. Jaunty melodies designed to inspire ever greater revolutionary fervour. Like this one, the storehouses are bursting with grain. But the reality was starkly different. Tens of millions of people had starved to death in the countryside over the preceding decade. In the words of historian Cheng Jin, Chinese society was on the verge of total collapse. Even Mao realised that it was time to wind down the Cultural Revolution. But he needed a bold new initiative to disguise his failure.
Therefore, increasingly Mao found the need to locate new means to prove that his revolution indeed had improved China, had made China a better country, a better place. And now, if a Chinese-American rapprochement could be pursued and achieved, that would allow Mao to tell the Chinese people, you see, after all, even the strongest nation in the world, namely the United States, would come to me
During the early months of 1970, China and the US were signalling to each other that they were interested in a new relationship. But the signals had to be kept totally secret, because officially the two countries were still sworn enemies. One of the first contacts happened when an American diplomat went up to a Chinese diplomat at a fashion show in Prague.
Oh, the types of contacts and the levels of contacts and the absurdity of some of the contacts was something that is actually more worthy of fiction of a novel than it is of an historian's work, because there were contacts in Poland, there were contacts in Bucharest, there were contacts in Paris, there was all kinds of stuff going on, and it was rather futile. The thing that finally saved us was that there was a channel that was opened through Pakistan, which was a very close ally of China. And the Pakistanis, of course, were also friends of the United States.
In the end, however, it was sport rather than diplomacy which gave Mao and Nixon their chance for a closer embrace.
Ping-pong diplomacy began in April with a surprise invitation to an American table tennis team to visit China.
Here you can see the ping-pong diplomacy, as it's been called, in close-up. But I think it ought to be explained that the choice of ping-pong by the Chinese as a way of opening up friendship with other countries is much more significant than it possibly seems to us, because table tennis is the number one sport in China and is played at every factory, every workshop. Tables are set up in corridors and there is fantastic interest in the game.
In the early 1970s, China was an isolated country, and the Chinese people lived a life which actually is a very boring, you know, in a normal sense. But I must say, you know, sports in any country, in any culture, in any society, in any civilization, sports is something which is very easy to cause excitement. And especially in China, ping pong, table tennis in the 1960s and 1970s, this is the major sport. This is the only sport in the world that China can claim a supremacy.
Mao's chance came with the World Table Tennis Championships in Nagoya, Japan in April 1971. The Chinese table tennis team was participating for the first time in 6 years, and excitement in China was intense.
And so easily it became such a national event. Millions and millions of Chinese, including myself, followed what was happening in Nagoya, Japan. Finally, China won 4 champions out of 7 events. And then in Nagoya, Japan, there was this unexpected contact between Chinese and American players.
Sometimes chance can change the course of history, or at least give it a shove in the right direction. One of the American players, Glenn Cowan, accidentally got on the wrong bus and found himself face to face with the entire Chinese ping pong team. For a few moments, they looked at each other, uncertain how to react. And then Zhuang Zedong, 3 times world champion for China, got up and gave Cowan an embroidered silk scarf as a goodwill gift. When they got off the bus together, waiting photographers snapped a historic shot of the two players smiling at each other. Next day, the long-haired American player Glenn Cowan gave Zhuang a present in return, a T-shirt printed with the title of the Beatles album, Let It Be. When Mao heard about the meeting, he said, "Zhuang Zedong not only plays good ping-pong, he also knows how to conduct diplomacy."
And when this was reported, and then together with this public excitement associated with the Chinese winning record at Nagoya, Japan's World Championship, Table Tennis Championship, it was very easily translated into a popular mood that Mao was very eager to stir up for changing the Chinese perception of the United States of America.
Mao himself was the prime mover inviting the U.S. ping pong team to travel to China.
Some other people below him had considered it, but sort of written it off as not being a great idea. But Mao reversed the decision and ordered the invitation be made. So this ping-pong diplomacy was very important, I think, in setting the tone for creating an atmosphere favoring a rapprochement between the U.S. and China.